those that fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Words that inspired Winston Churchill's famous speech, and a new book examining the rise and fall of seven Golden Age civilizations, indeed offers some historical lessons for the 21st century.
In times when we began to fear the world, we think that a quick solution is to just shut it out and stay away from it all. And that's really a dangerous temptation, because that's the one that makes us lose the ability to learn how to handle it.
Johan Norberg is the author of Peak Human, What We Can Learn from History's Greatest Civilizations, which focuses on highly innovative societies that were unusually open to new ideas. Look for his article, based on the book, in the December edition of Finance and Development magazine. Norberg is an historian and a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Journalist Rhoda Metcalf caught up with him to talk about his latest book.
There have been many powerful, prosperous empires throughout history, but you include just seven in your recent book that you consider golden age civilizations. So what makes these seven so golden?
Often when people talk about strong civilizations, they think about mighty empires and territorial expansion, but often the kind of life that they made possible was quite depressing, full of oppression and poverty and slavery. That's not what I have in mind. I have in mind civilizations that created something that was valuable to people who lived there. Better living standards, more opportunities. So it's usually associated with creative explosions, technological innovation, cultural creativity and economic innovation. And then I thought these seven civilizations, they should be included on that list.
Right. So these are societies that had, there's innovation, but there's also sort of a larger percentage of the population that are benefiting from this prosperity. Is that the idea?
Yeah. Not all of them, obviously. Mary Beard, the classicist, often points out that when people envy life in ancient Rome, they always think that they would have been senators or the emperor in that culture. The risk is much greater that they would have been desperately poor peasants or slaves. They all had some forms of slavery and oppression. What set these golden ages apart was that for a broader section of people, they had better living standards, more opportunities, higher real wages, the ability to feed themselves and their families.
And I guess central to your thesis is that these golden age civilizations had a lot of innovation, that there was an openness to dialogue in society. Do I understand that right?
That's right. Something happened that made these cultures very innovative. So they saw changes in many different sectors in society simultaneously, in art, in literature, in business models, in production methods and shipping. So you saw this accumulation of change.
So were there certain patterns, certain conditions that existed in almost all of these civilizations that allowed the golden age to appear?
I think there was. So, first of all, they imitated a lot. It's very difficult to come up with new ways of life, but it's easier when you learn from others. So they were often at the crossroads between other civilizations, learned from them, right, from other city-states. They were always traders, maritime cultures, so they saw other ways of producing, of living, of implementing institutions, so that helped them to compare, to learn, and then to test something new back home.
Right, right. So, I mean, trade was certainly a big aspect of all of these societies, right?
Yes, definitely. And not just to create more wealth and access to goods that they couldn't produce themselves, but also to just to broaden minds. Everywhere from philosophy, when Aristotle came up with his perfect Greek constitution, he first compared 158 other Greek constitutions to financial models, from Arabic numerals to ways of handling risk on your shipping ventures. That's something they saw and brought back home from other places where they did trade.
Right. So you have these seven empires or dynasties that you look at. You start with the Greek and Romans, which are certainly empires with great thinkers that most people are pretty familiar with. But the next Golden Age civilization that you examine is based in Baghdad, the Abbasid Empire. I get the impression from the book that this civilization, it surprised you a little. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair. This was, I would say, the culture that I knew the least of. But obviously, right. I've noticed you don't have to go further than the letter A to realize how much in debt we are to this Arabic civilization. You know, arithmetic, algebra, algorithms, the concept of average in mathematics. Mm-hmm. We got them all from that place. And that's because they built this huge free trade area from North Africa to Central Asia, all the way to Afghanistan, under one system of laws, which made it possible for merchants and adventurers to travel and to learn from all these other cultures and civilizations, and being then in the 8th, 9th century, the most tolerant civilization. So they invited scholars and philosophers from all ethnicities and religions to hear what they had to say, translate their books, and then build on top of that. And that made them more innovative in science and technology than anybody else at that time.
I had the sense when I read this particular chapter that you had a particular fondness for the Abbasids, because in this society, finally, the merchant becomes the hero.
Yes, that's true. Because, you know, the merchant is a bit of a hero in all of these civilizations, because you need those traders and adventurers to see something new and to create something new.
But they're not always respected.
Exactly. In ancient Athens, in ancient Rome, they depended on merchants, but they thought that that was something best left to foreigners and to slaves or freed slaves, because it wasn't really dignified. Even the sort of sophisticated thinkers like Aristotle and Cicero, they thought this is really degrading for people to make money and to engage in trade. You should rather own land and think and contemplate about deep thoughts. Right. But the Abbasids, they were the first of these civilizations that really thought about coming up with new business models, new ways of doing trade as a dignified profession. Mm-hmm. I mean, whereas Jesus talked about how it was easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter paradise, Muhammad, on the other side, talked about the honest merchant as being on the side of the prophets.
Right.
So that tells you something about a culture that really encouraged entrepreneurship and trade.
And you speak about the famous Arabian Nights folk tales that come out of this period, where instead of the prince going out in pursuit of a damsel or something, it's a businessman or it's a merchant who's going to, you know, seek his fortune.
Isn't that interesting? You have individuals like Sinbad the Seafarer, who ventures out defying monsters and cannibals and storms to make money, to do business.
Making profit.
Right.
Right, right. That was it's really interesting society. Also, the Abbasids came up with this idea of experimentation, right? They came up with the idea of testing out ideas, which became such an important concept later in science, right?
Yeah, I have really underestimated their influence on the European Renaissance and the Industrial Revolution. So if you noticed that I was I wrote in a more inspired way about them, it was because that was a journey of discovery for me as well.
Yeah, interesting. I found it intriguing to see what triggered the creation of some of these Golden Age societies. In China, in the Song Dynasty, which was, I guess, based in Guangzhou, you say that it was the creation of a professional army and a civilian bureaucracy based on meritocracy that were key to, you know, allowing this dynasty to flourish. Why was that so important?
Yeah, often Golden Ages are created a little bit by accident. Sort of stumble onto a particular trajectory, and that creates other effects.
Yeah,
and in this instance, the traditional, more feudal system where farmers were tied to the land, it broke down during chaos and civil war. So instead, they had to raise money to fund an army. And in that case, you need tax revenue. And to get tax revenue, they began to encourage and stimulate mobility and urbanization and commerce and trade, because it was much easier to raise tax revenue out of that. So
out of an urban population.
That's right. So they lifted restrictions on mobility, they lifted restrictions on trade and on urbanization, and also with huge infrastructure projects like canals encouraged trade between the different regions.
Mm-hmm. And I guess also the having this civilian bureaucracy that anyone essentially could become part of if they were sufficiently educated, encouraged education and literacy and an effort at social mobility.
That's right. So they had this famous civil service exams, very tricky and difficult. Yes. You had to prepare for years to have even a chance. But that created the ability for some sort of meritocracy. Mm-hmm. And importantly, you did it by studying literature and books and to learn. So again, we see that encouraging learning and literature is something that facilitates a particular civilizational trajectory.
Mm-hmm. Another pattern that you talk about a lot in these civilizations is the fact that they are open to foreigners, to immigrants, you know, which certainly has echoes in our modern age. Can you talk about how that openness to the outsider coming in changed the dynamics in these civilizations?
Yeah, well, if you want more ideas, it's easier if you don't have to come up with all of them, but instead you can borrow some talent from abroad, and mm-hmm. all of these seven civilizations relative to neighbors were more open in various ways, some of them to a dramatic extent, like the Roman Republic mm-hmm. and the Roman Empire, which actively encouraged the integration of new populations. They were quite brutal in their warfare, obviously, but mm-hmm. What set them apart from other conquerors was that they, after having defeated a population, they tried to integrate them instantly. So Emperor Claudius famously talked about how we can defeat and integrate a population during the same day. So now we've fought against the Gauls for 100 years. Now let's make use of them, allowing them to have a career in business, in the military, even in the Senate. And that mm-hmm. was a way then to acquire more talent and more people in their societies. And the same goes for the Dutch Republic, famously being open to dissenters and Enlightenment thinkers from other places. Descartes comes there from France. John Locke comes there from England. Spinoza's mm-hmm. family from Portugal. These are then a melting pot of brand new ideas about right. science, about the world that really, I think, unleashes the modern world.
Hmm. You also put a lot of emphasis on private property rules. Why is private property so crucial in this evolution of these sort of golden age societies?
Well, we can start with ancient Athens. If you plant an olive tree, it might mm-hmm. take you 15, 20 years for it to bear fruit. Right. So why would you do that if there's one aristocrat or a warlord who will seize it all once it bears fruit? So having that secure property makes you interested in investing and tending to it, but also to experiment with it and trying to come up with something even better, like the farmers in Song China, who knew that if they planted new rice varieties that were higher yield or better in other ways, they would eventually make a lot of money out of that. And that's something you just don't do if you're a serf tending right. to the property of a warlord or aristocrat.
And this is interesting when you talk about the idea of experimentation. You point this out in your F&D article. A piece of what was going on in these golden ages was the confidence to experiment and to fail, which is kind of interesting. The idea that, you know, in order to innovate, you have to be willing to fail. How do you know that this was happening in those societies? Did they write about their failures? I mean, how do you know that this was a part of these societies?
Yeah, that is interesting because they began to talk about the joy of testing new things. And mm-hmm. That's quite rare in history. We talk about it all the time nowadays, obviously. But, you know, historically close to subsistence level, you don't want too much innovation because most forms of innovation fail. And that might lead
risk,
to the whole family or the village to hunger. So you need something else. You need that kind of culture of possibility. You know, some technology historians have been surprised that it took such a long time for some quite simple innovations to take place, you know, like the flying shuttle that made weaving much more efficient.
Okay.
As Anton Haus put it, any weaver during the last 5,000 years should have been able, through a simple process of trial and error, to come up with it. But nobody did. You needed the Industrial Revolution and the Enlightenment to give people the confidence to test something brand new. When they see a steam engine and when they see a hot air balloon or something like that, they begin to think, oh, I might even improve my own profession here and my own weaving.
All of these prosperous, innovative societies eventually go into decline. Was there a common pattern to that decline?
Well, if you build golden ages through this kind of openness to learning and acquiring, trading, then you lose it when you close your societies to those influences. You become fearful of the world. You try to protect yourself by reimposing orthodoxies or dismantling much of that openness to outsiders.
So generally, that's where the decline starts, is this sense of hunkering down because you've got an enemy to face.
Yeah, we have war, we have climate changes that result in famine and pandemics, and they're often devastating. History speaks quite loudly on that point, that in times when we began to fear the world, we think that a quick solution is to just shut it out and stay away from it all. And that's really a dangerous temptation because that's the one that makes us lose the ability to learn how to handle it.
And the impulse to innovate and the impulse to try new things.
Yeah, you return to that don't rock the boat mentality. Let's try to stick to what we already know. But we know from history that that's often how you lose what you already have because that also takes constant hard work to stay capable and competitive and to keep exploring the world. But that's what you often lose in the decline phase of these civilizations. When we get worried, we have this fight or flight tendency to get away from the intellectual openness that made us strong.
One thing that we have today that didn't exist in those previous eras is a system of multilateral organizations like the IMF, you know, that stretch beyond one particular dynasty and connect countries around the world. What role do you see potentially for multilaterals in sustaining the kind of openness to trade and ideas that exist in today's world?
In a way, this golden era that we're in right now is the most golden of them all, because for the first time, progress has not been limited to one particular region. For the first time, we've created a rules-based order where it's possible for even small countries in the periphery, like my own Sweden and all over the world, places have been able to, through digital communication and trade, then have access to knowledge, to technology, and to begin to prosper as well. And that takes a particular world order. It takes this kind of attempt to find rules, negotiations, compromises, mutually beneficial trade, rather than, you know, having soldiers cross the border. That's a fairly new phenomenon in the world. And how we then learn from each other and what we're doing in various ways, spreading that knowledge through the IMF and other institutions, that's something that helps all civilizations to thrive. And in a way, it's a way of not having all the eggs in one basket. You know, once upon a time when Rome declined and fell, that was 500 years of darkness, because we lost knowledge and capacity that we had to relearn eventually. Nowadays, hopefully we don't, because we have more places that can use and benefit and then spread the best solutions around the world.
Well, it's a fascinating book with a lot of takeaways for us to think about in our current economy. Johan Norberg, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Again, that was Rhoda Metcalf speaking with Johan Norberg, historian and author of Peak Human, What We Can Learn from History's Greatest Civilizations. His article, Why Civilizations Flourish and Fail, is published in the December edition of Finance and Development magazine. Go to imf.org/FND. And look for other IMF podcasts on Apple Podcasts, on YouTube, or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X. Our handle is @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards.
And I'm Rhoda Metcalf. Thanks for listening.